For Robin Young, it's here and now. Just days after he resigned his congressional seat, Florida Republican Mark Foley has checked himself in to an alcohol rehabilitation clinic as the FBI begins to investigate sexually explicit emails, instant messages, and text messages he sent to high school pages. The scandal's raising questions about how much Republican congressional leaders knew about these correspondences and whether they did enough to protect the teenagers. All of this comes just weeks before the midterm elections, which could shift the balance of power in Congress. With the latest on the Foley investigation, we're joined by Linda Feldman of the Christian Science Monitor from Washington. Welcome, Linda.
Hi, Deb.
The Foley camp released a press statement when he checked himself into this facility, apparently. What exactly are they saying now, and what does this mean?
Well, now we have Mark Foley saying that he strongly believes he's an alcoholic, and he's going to get treatment for alcoholism and other behavioral problems. So I guess that's a veiled reference to him dealing with his issues with teenage boys.
Let's just recap briefly about what has happened so far with these correspondences with the teenage pages in Washington.
Sure. A key thing to keep in mind in all of this is that there are two sets of electronic messages. There are the, quote, over-friendly emails that he was exchanging with a former page about a year ago, which were just a little weird but not overtly sexual. Then there are the overtly sexual electronic messages. I've heard either instant messages or text messages that were overtly sexual and disgusting. If you want to go online and read them, I won't get into details.
Mm-hmm.
It was brought to the attention of the House leadership that these over-friendly emails were being sent, and so Mark Foley was instructed to keep away from this page. What the leadership is saying is they didn't know about the overtly sexual ones. And there remains a question. It's a classic what did they know and when did they know it situation. The leadership is saying they didn't know about the overtly sexual stuff. And they have, you know, condemned his actions, of course, and have called for an investigation by the FBI into what exactly Foley did and also who had access to these emails, who knew what, when, and what should have been done.
So when we hear Republican Representative Tom Reynolds of New York say, I told House Speaker Hastert months ago about these emails, he's talking about the overly friendly emails, and Hastert is saying that he doesn't have any recollection, he only learned about these emails last week. What they're talking about here is the first set of emails, not the disgusting set of emails.
Exactly. The disgusting stuff we're all learning about just now, and we don't know, we in the public are learning about, what we don't know is what the leadership actually knew about the disgusting stuff. They're claiming they had no idea.
Okay. Well, at the time, Foley was co-chair of the House Caucus on Missing and Exploited Children, and he helped sponsor numerous bills designed to protect children from predators. Democrats are saying he should have been pulled from that committee.
It's a sign of even the slightest bit of trouble. You know, emails that are making a 16-year-old page feel kind of creepy. He called them sick. Why even that kind of creepy and sick but not overtly sexual thing was considered okay somehow, and that they didn't go to Mark Foley and suggest to him that he retire and get this out of the way early in the cycle as opposed to having it blow up in their face a month before the election.
I've read that some of the pages describe Foley as being a lawmaker who took an interest in them, who helped them. Can you tell us just briefly about the program itself? I mean, is there really very limited interaction between the teenagers who participate in it and the lawmakers? And so perhaps this would have raised red flags because of his behavior before this?
Well, it's possible. I mean, the pages have a lot of interaction with members. They're gophers. They're performing necessary but menial tasks for members. The members typically don't pay a whole lot of attention to them. They're at the bottom of the food chain. Foley, as you mentioned, was very nice to the pages. He would talk to them. He would exchange friendly emails with them. He would show up at the end of their time on Capitol Hill, would show up at their, I guess, their like graduation ceremonies. So he was friendly and you know, paid attention to them and became their friends, which in and of itself should not be bad. it's one of those things where, you know, you have somebody who is either openly gay or suspected of being gay, and you don't want to make any assumptions about how they relate to teenagers. Mm-hmm. So this is one of those terrible situations where apparently there should have been concern about how he related to teenagers, but nobody, you know, you want to give someone the benefit of the doubt.
Mm-hmm. Democrats need to gain 15 seats to take control of the House, and Foley was expected to win. Now that he's gone, what happens?
The Foley seat, I would say, will be very difficult to hold on to. The Republican Executive Board of Florida is meeting today to replace Foley. They're expected to select a state rep named Joe Negron, who's very popular, but he's got a big uphill task, particularly because his name won't appear on the ballot. Mark Foley's name will be on the ballot, and any vote for him will go to his replacement. So explaining that to voters, this is a huge district that goes all the way from the East Coast, Stuart, Florida, Martin County, all the way almost to the West Coast. So you've got the big, the big ranches in the middle of the state. That seat, I would say that seat's gone. I would say before this broke, the race to take over the House by the Democrats was really close. This could be the tipping point. This could put it over the edge for Democratic control.
That was Linda Feldman, political and White House correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. We're shifting focus now to the U.S. Senate. Two new polls show that Democrats may be getting closer to regaining control of that chamber. The polling, which was done last week for McClatchy Newspapers and MSNBC, shows in every one of 10 key Senate races, Democrats are either tied, have a slight edge, or an outright lead. Democrats need to gain 6 seats to take back the Senate, and the conventional wisdom was that the Senate was farther out of reach than the House for Democrats. Today, we'll look at 2 tight races in New Jersey and Rhode Island, where a new poll shows maverick Republican incumbent Lincoln Chafee trailing 1 percentage point behind Democrat Sheldon Whitehouse. Joining us on the line is Darrell West. He's a professor of political science at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. And Darrell, first I'd like to ask you for your thoughts on the scandal involving former Congressman Foley. Do you think that that's affecting the race in Rhode Island at all?
I don't think it directly affects the Senate race, but it just reminds people one more time that the National Republican Party has had a wide range of problems, ethics problems. There have been people who have had to resign office after indictment. There have been various scandals that are now coming to the forefront. So, this is probably the worst public opinion climate facing Republicans since they took control of the Congress back in 1994.
So, Darrell, are you surprised then about the numbers out today in the Rhode Island Senate race? Republican incumbent Lincoln Chafee is a percentage point behind his Democratic challenger, Sheldon Whitehouse, 42% to 41%?
Not really. This is one of the premier Senate races in the country. The incumbent, Lincoln Chafee, is a moderate Republican who's representing a Democratic state. And so, obviously, that creates some political problems for him. And we have a former Attorney General, a Democrat, who's running a very strong and vigorous campaign against Chafee. And it looks like that's a race that'll go all the way down to the wire.
Why so close?
This is such a polarized political era, and people in Rhode Island really dislike George Bush's job performance. And the irony is, even though Chafee has actually voted against Bush on a number of occasions, he voted against Iraq, voted against the Bush tax cuts, that Bush is dragging down Chafee in this very polarized political environment.
So this is actually part of a broader sort of anti-Republican, anti-incumbent sentiment that is what we're seeing in the Rhode Island race, you would say?
I think certainly in New England that is playing a role. I mean, in Rhode Island, for example, George Bush has a 22% job approval rating, which has to be one of his lowest ratings anywhere in the country. People are upset with Iraq, the aftermath of Katrina. They're worried about the economy. So there's not a lot of things going the way of Republicans right now.
In the primary, Lincoln Chafee had quite a bit of help from national Republican operatives in the campaign. Do you think that's going to come back to haunt him here?
I think that will come back to haunt him. Democrats certainly are basically saying Lincoln Chafee is a nice guy. He often votes with us. But on the crucial issue of control of the Senate and cozying up to George Bush, Chafee votes with Republicans when they really need him. So I think a lot of their race is really coming down to this effort to try and nationalize the campaign, whereas Chafee wants to personalize the campaign and say, hey, I'm a good guy. You know me. My family has been in public office for 40 years. Go with me because we have such a reputation for honesty and integrity.
So this poll that says Chafee has 41% of the vote compared with his Democratic challenger, Sheldon Whitehouse, at 42%, would you read that as saying this is big trouble for an incumbent?
generally, if you're an incumbent and you're below 50%, that is certainly flashing warning signs, because oftentimes when people are unhappy with the direction of the country, the late deciding vote often breaks almost two-thirds in favor of the challenger and one-third in favor of the incumbent. So if an incumbent doesn't have a lead going into the last week of the campaign, that incumbent should be worried.
So do you think the conventional wisdom is wrong here, Daryl, and Democrats will win the Senate?
I think this is the best shot Democrats have had at regaining control of Congress in more than 10 years. The Republicans really have controlled both of the House and the Senate for almost all of that time for the last 12 years. And I think Democrats have a very good shot of picking up a majority both in the House and the Senate.
All right, Daryl, thanks very much for speaking with us. Daryl West, a professor of political science at Brown University. Thank you.
Thank you.
We turn now to New Jersey and the race between incumbent Democrat Bob Menendez and his Republican challenger Thomas Kane Jr., son of former New Jersey Governor Tom Kane, who also headed the 9/11 Commission. This is the one seat that Democrats are most worried about losing in November. The polls give Menendez 44% support over Kane's 41%. Herb Jackson covers politics for the Record of North Jersey. And Herb, these numbers aren't very good for Menendez. Why is that?
Well, he's got a number of problems. First of all, he was never elected to the Senate. He was appointed in January because Governor Corzine had been Senator Corzine and appointed Menendez, who had been a member of the House, to replace him. So he's never run statewide before. And he's running against a name, which is the Kane name, you know, probably much like the Chafee name in Rhode Island. It's very well liked. There was a recent poll of people's opinions of former governors, and Tom Kane's father was the highest rated. Democrats have also been dealing with a couple of years of scandals in New Jersey. Kane has been savaging Menendez on ethics issues, and so he's largely unknown, and what people are hearing about him for the first time is bad things. So he's having trouble in a year that otherwise you would think a Democrat would do pretty well, especially in New Jersey.
Right. Do you think Menendez might do what these other lawmakers have done and bow out?
It does not look likely. From what I can tell, first of all, he doesn't want to go anywhere. This is his, the capstone of his career that he's wanted to be a senator. But at the same time, the Democrats don't have somebody to put in his place with who can take on the Kane name. Plus, Democrats don't know whether voters will take it. You know, would they pay for it at the polls if they pulled what they call the switcheroo again? They don't think so.
Herb Jackson is Washington correspondent for The Record of North Jersey. We're talking about the tight Senate race in New Jersey. It's one seat that Democrats are nervous about losing in next month's elections. There's more about the campaign in the Garden State coming up here and now. Here and now. We're back with Herb Jackson, Washington correspondent for The Record of North Jersey, about one of the battleground Senate races in the midterm elections, which are now just 5 weeks away. And Herb, before the break, you were saying that Senator Bob Menendez will not abandon his reelection bid despite a corruption scandal involving his now former campaign advisor. The advisor apparently was taped promising favorable contracts in exchange for a political hiring. How are voters reacting to this? I've read that there may be a mindset of who's scarier here, Republicans in Washington or Democrats in New Jersey?
Well, I'm not sure. It's a personality thing versus a policy thing. Governor Corzine has maintained his popularity despite raising taxes in the summer. And it's one of these questions, but the Democrats themselves have a series of political scandals that have been breaking year after year. And the Republicans believe that at some point some Democrat has to pay the price for this corruption, and they want it to be Bob Menendez. But there's other people who believe that there's a sort of a corruption fatigue in the New Jersey voter, that they just assume they're all evil, and now they move on to the next question. And that's what we don't know, how the voters are going to react next month.
So you're saying that this latest scandal may not be all that damaging for Menendez?
Well, no, it's definitely damaging. In any day that Menendez has to spend talking about himself and talking about his dealings in Hudson County instead of talking about Iraq and the war and President Bush is a bad day for Bob Menendez. So I'm not minimizing that at all. But what I'm saying is that it may not be the nail in the coffin that some people think it is. Now, before that scandal, Menendez had to deal with another scandal where he had owned a building that a nonprofit in the area had leased. He was working to win federal funding for that nonprofit. So Kane has been able to say that Menendez took $300,000 in federal grants and put it in his own pocket because it went through this nonprofit. Menendez has argued that he leased the building at market rate. I'm not sure how voters are going to react to that. It's all one of these things where is there a taint? The people have already figured the taint into their assessment of the candidates and they're moving on to something, or is the taint enough that they're going to say, I can't have that guy?
What about his record? Menendez voted with the Republicans last week on the president's bill to create military commissions for terrorist suspects. Any fallout from that?
Yeah, there was. There was some on, you know, there's a blog that's called Blue Jersey. There were a lot of people who were very outraged by it. Other people were saying, you know, this was a set-up vote by Karl Rove to make the Democrats have a choice that they couldn't win. I'm not sure how many actual regular voters were even in tune with that. It's one of these things where if you're going to find a state where people wanted them to vote against it, it would probably be New Jersey, because there tend to be more liberal people in New Jersey. But you could also find that, you know, all Menendez had to do was vote against the bill, and you know, there would have been the ads that put him up on television next to Osama bin Laden. And I'm not sure what his calculation was. He says that he voted for it because we need to have a legal process, and the president's program was illegal. That didn't fly with some of the liberal bloggers. I'm not sure where it falls in the vote. But his overall record has been he's voted for the kinds of things that Democrats consider litmus tests. He's voted for abortion rights, for gun control bills. He voted, one of his first votes as a senator in January was against Sam Alito's confirmation to the Supreme Court. He's been more pro-business than some Democrats in Washington, and he's clearly not one of the most liberal members of the New Jersey delegation. He sort of falls in the middle of the Democratic delegation overall in the ratings of liberal versus conservative. He's of Cuban descent, so he's been a hard line against Fidel Castro, often fighting with other Democrats on the side with the Republicans against that. And he's basically talked about issues like college tuition, some health care issues, things like that.
Any prediction?
I don't make predictions.
All right. Herb, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Herb Jackson is Washington correspondent for The Record of North Jersey. His blog can be found at northjersey.com. Thank you.
Okay.
The Nobel Prize in Medicine was awarded to two Americans today. Andrew Fire and Craig Mello will share the prize for discovering a powerful way to turn off the effects of specific genes. Their discovery, a process known as RNA interference, is widely used to study the function of genes, and it could open a new avenue in the fight against diseases as diverse as cancer and AIDS. Fire teaches at Stanford University and Mello at the University of Massachusetts Medical School in Worcester. Earlier today, Mello told Here and Now's Bob Oakes about the Nobel-winning research.
What we discovered back in the mid-90s, really, is that there's a remarkable silencing effect in organisms when they're exposed to RNA. Normally RNA is expressed in the cell as a messenger that makes the proteins that make our cells do what they do. We discovered that the double-stranded form of RNA can induce an interference effect that shuts off the the gene. It's related to an immune response or an antiviral mechanism, because double-stranded RNA is often the genetic material of viruses. So that's at least one hypothesis for how this mechanism originated as an immune response that cells develop to combat viral infection.
So if you can silence genes, that may have implications for the treatment or maybe someday the prevention of Lou Gehrig's disease, diabetes, Alzheimer's?
It would be tremendous. It'd be wonderful if we can learn how to deliver and make this work in a therapeutic setting. And I think that there's real hope that we can do that.
That's Craig Mello of the University of Massachusetts Medical Center in Worcester. He's co-winner, along with Stanford's Andrew Fier, of the 2006 Nobel Prize in Medicine. He spoke with Here and Now's Bob Oakes. Stay with us. You're listening to Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from
For Robin Young, it's Here and Now. A new study is expected to boost efforts to counsel pregnant women to take better care of themselves. The study, published in the journal Pediatrics, says the most common killer of newborns is not birth defects or other health problems, but premature birth. Although preterm birth has been listed as the cause of death in about 20% of babies who die before their first birthday, this new study says the figure should be 34% or higher. That's because at least a dozen causes of newborn deaths are actually problems that go hand in hand with premature birth. Dr. Bill Callahan from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta is lead author of this study. And Dr. Callahan, could you tell us more? What exactly did your study find?
We were really interested in trying to understand the whole issue of infant mortality, that is, why 7 out of every 1,000 infants die during their first year of life. We were initially puzzled that when we looked at grossly at the numbers, about 2/3 of all infants who die are born preterm, but preterm birth, in traditional way of counting, accounts for only about 17% of infant deaths in the official statistics. And we found that conservatively about 1/3 of all deaths were due to being born preterm, making preterm birth the most frequent reason that infants die. Moreover, we found that the majority of deaths that we found as being due to preterm birth occurred to the smallest and most premature infants, and that these infants often die within the first week of life.
So would you say then that basically, although other health reasons had been listed as the cause of death for these infants, a lot of those health problems were caused because of preterm births, so that is actually a broader category for cause of death?
Exactly.
Okay. Can you define exactly what preterm means?
Preterm birth, by definition, is any infant that is born at less than 37 weeks gestation, that is, more than 3 weeks before the official due date.
That seems to me relatively late. I would think preterm would have been much sooner than that in a pregnancy.
There are risks that begin accruing as soon as 3 weeks prior to due date, but the greatest risk, and you're right about that, is even earlier than that. And in fact, in our study, we found that while we used the official diagnosis of preterm birth, that is, at 37 weeks gestation, most of the preterm infants who died and who died because they were born preterm were actually born at less than 32 weeks gestation, or about 2 months before the due date.
And what's the biggest problem, would you say, for these preterm babies? What do they struggle with the most here?
Well, what they struggle with the most is immaturity of the lungs, but the earlier an infant is preterm, there are other aspects of the total biologic maturity. It takes a certain biologic maturity to be able to survive outside the womb, and although there have been incredible advancements in technology that help preterm infants survive better, and they survive better now than any time in history. This intensive care is still not always successful, and it's even less successful for the extremely small and the extremely premature infant.
Hmm. So do you think that because you can sort of reclassify, really, and get a better handle on a cause of death, that this will help reduce infant mortality in a way?
We think that in the long run it does help reduce infant mortality, but it helps reduce infant mortality because it shines a light on this very vexing and difficult problem to understand. We can describe some risk factors for being preterm. We know that a woman who has had a preterm birth is more likely to have a preterm birth in subsequent pregnancies. We know that women that smoke are slightly increased to have preterm births, but quite honestly, it is very difficult to be able to predict preterm birth for any given woman. We know that in spite of risk factors, this is a problem that crosses every line that we draw. So what we really need is a very comprehensive research agenda so that we can really understand what it is that causes preterm birth, what makes women susceptible to preterm birth. And in the end, that's what's ultimately going to lead to rational interventions to prevent these births.
Right, because at this point we may know that there are certain risk factors, but there are a lot of questions that still remain as to exactly why babies are born early, right?
That's exactly right. Knowing a risk factor, for example, the risk factor that a woman has had a preterm birth, still doesn't explain why.
So what would you advocate then to pregnant women and to their family members about how to try to ensure, is there advice how to try to ensure that they don't have a preterm birth?
I don't think that we can offer insurance about preterm birth. I think we can say that there are certain behaviors that will reduce or modify risk. Clearly, smoking is probably the one that comes to mind, and stopping smoking. But even when women do everything right, sometimes their births are premature. It's important that women be involved in care, that they discuss their concerns with their providers, that they pay attention to subtleties. But until we really understand this problem, babies are going to be born preterm, and unfortunately, I think some of them are going to die.
And what about the ones who don't, doctor? Do they have long-term problems, would you say? Or if they survive after their first year, do they seem to be okay?
It's like many other health outcomes. When we measure mortality as the end point, while it's easy to measure, it's really the tip of the iceberg. And clearly, preterm birth is also a leading cause of disability. And again, the more preterm, the smaller the infant is, the more likely that these babies and their families will be faced with disabilities.
Dr. Callahan, thanks very much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Dr. William Callahan is senior scientist at the Centers for Disease Control's Maternal and Infant Health Branch. He's the lead author of a new study that says a third of infant deaths, that's a baby who dies before his or her first birthday, are actually due to premature births, a much larger percentage than previously thought. The study appears in the journal Pediatrics. And this note, Turkey's prime minister is calling on President Bush to crack down on Kurdish rebels based in northern Iraq who are linked to a wave of attacks in southern Turkey. The two leaders met in the Oval Office today and discussed that issue as well as the growing rift between the West and traditional Muslim countries. Turkey is also seeking support in its bid for European Union membership. One stumbling block is questions about freedom of speech in Turkey. Last month, we spoke with Turkish writer Elif Shafak, who was charged with insulting Turkishness in her novel, The Bastard of Istanbul. She was the latest in a series of writers accused on similar charges. In this update, Shafak was acquitted, and so far, none of the writers charged has been sent to prison. But Shafak says the law is a way of intimidating writers and controlling dissent in Turkey. Stay with us. You're listening to Here and Now. It's time now for a real fluff piece, and we mean this literally, the real fluff, the kind you spread between a couple of slices of Wonder Bread or mix with peanut butter to make a fluffernutter. A staple in the diets of generations of kids, especially in the Northeast, fluff is pure white sticky goo made of marshmallows and other ingredients that we don't have the time or the required degree in chemistry to mention here. And its nutritional value? Well, let's just say you won't find it on the counter of your local health food store. And because of that, fluff has become something of a controversial condiment. A state senator in Massachusetts wants to ban fluff from public school cafeterias, saying it contributes to childhood obesity. Another lawmaker wants to make fluffernutters the official state sandwich. The concoction was, after all, invented in Somerville, Massachusetts back in 1917. This past weekend, in spite of the political kerfluffle, a group of artists, bakers, and fluff fans gathered in Somerville to celebrate fluff. Here and now, producer Kevin Donovan was there, and he has this audio postcard.
A long line of people is already snaking through Union Square at the start of the What the Fluff Festival, all of them waiting to buy Rice Krispie treats and fluffernutters and other gooey goods. In the middle of the square is a troupe of burlesque dancers decked out in heavy makeup, sequins, silvery tassels, and boas. They are the Flufferettes, the reincarnation of Fluff's original marketing campaign from the early 1900s. They're doing a dance number to Brenda Lee's Marshmallow World.
And when it's a marshmallow world, it's a marshmallow world.
The festival's organizer, Mimi Graney, explains what's on the schedule.
Well, we're planning a science fair, inviting people to come up with scientific experiments that, you know, measure or pay tribute to Fluff. Then we've got a cooking contest. So we're having a tug-of-war and a vat of fluff.
Easily the most popular attraction is the bake-off, where all sorts of fluff-inspired treats are waiting to get judged.
So this is like a mint chocolate whoopie pie. This person has made pumpkin fluff spread with ginger snaps. There's various different whoopie pies. We've got a fluffernutter cupcake. There's been a couple different entries with different sorts of fudge, a couple different truffles.
And then a fluff cup, a cup of fluff.
And it's hot chocolate cake with fluff on top, so it's actually in a mug.
By far, the most over-the-top of the fluff treats is already hidden away in a nearby building where the judging is about to take place. It's a fluff volcano, and its creators, who call themselves fluffologists, are very excited about it.
This is an erupting fluff volcano. It is also a dense chocolate almond tube cake with bruleed marshmallow frosting, a chocolate glaze on a graham cracker base. So it's both classy with a C and classy with a K.
Okay. I'll be about really.
And it will erupt with little dry ice and fluff. There will be fluff lava spewing from it at a later time.
The bake-off contest has started inside. Two of the judges are professional chefs, while the third is Fluff Boy, an 8-year-old kid named Michael, who's dressed in a red cape, white face paint, and has a big F for fluff on his t-shirt.
His inception came from his godmother. She's an artist, and she had the idea to, a couple weeks ago, she came to the house, and we covered Michael in 6 jars of fluff.
5.
5 jars of fluff, and we took a bunch of pictures, and she, you know, get them flying over the city of Somerville, and...
Did you get cleaned up pretty easily from that?
It's very easy. Jump in the shower, just washes right off.
No way.
Yeah. No? You didn't think
I
it was easy?
I had to towel and scrub till my arms turned red.
Oh, you did?
They're really handy gowns. They stick on really well.
I thought it came off pretty easy.
No.
Fluff Boy gets off to a good start in the judging, but after about 15 sugar-filled treats, he's had enough.
Yep, he's throwing up. Okay. It's okay.
I'm so sorry.
That's okay.
No worries.
Don't step in it.
All right, let me get you
right
there.
I'll get some paper.
What was the last one you tried?
Fluff Boy's mother can barely contain herself as she helps her son, saying even with something like marshmallow fluff, you can sometimes get too much of a good thing.
Oh, you need fluff.
That was Here and Now producer Kevin Donovan. To see photos from the What the Fluff Festival, including the Flufferette burlesque dancers and an all-out fluff fight, go to our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now.
You're fluffing peanut butter. You're glad you have enough for another fluffer nutter. Oh, you need fluff.
Thank you.
Here and Now. After 40 years and 13 novels, Adam Dalgliesh, the Scotland Yard inspector and poet, created by renowned British mystery writer P.D. James, is still winning readers. James' most recent book in the series, The Lighthouse, was a New York Times bestseller when it came out in hardcover last year. The paperback version is being released this month. The Lighthouse offers a rich menu of murder. In the book, Dalgliesh and his team are investigating the death of a famous writer who is found hanging from a lighthouse on an isolated island retreat. But there are personal ramifications for Commander Dalgliesh and his team, including Detective Inspector Kate Mishkin, who has her own reservations about the case.
Somewhere, as yet only imagined, a body was lying in the cold abstraction of death. A group of people was waiting for the police to arrive, some distressed, most apprehensive, one surely sharing her intoxicated mixture of excitement and resolve. It had always worried her that someone had to die before she could experience this half-guilty exhilaration. And there would be the part she most enjoyed, the team get-together at the end of the day, when Adam Dalgliesh, herself and Benton Smith would ponder over the evidence, picking up, discarding, or clicking the clues into place as they might the pieces of a jigsaw. But she knew the root of the small sprig of shame. Although they had never spoken of it, she suspected that Dalgliesh felt the same. With this jigsaw, the pieces were the broken lives of men and women.
That's P.D. James reading from her book, The Lighthouse. Robin Young spoke with Baroness James when the book came out last year.
Just in that reading you gave us, there was a phrase in there that jumps out, sprig of shame. What is that sprig of shame that these detectives feel approaching a case?
Well, I think Kate, who's really a very sensitive woman, does hugely enjoy her job. And it's immensely exciting, that first moment when you see the body and the mysteries before you and you know you're going to solve it. And someone has died, and died horribly. And she is always aware, as is in fact Adam Dalgliesh, they're always aware of the victim and the suffering of the victim.
In fact, there's a passage where Detective Dalgliesh reflects on, you know, how the Secret Service has this sort of, as he puts it, or as you put it, half-ecclesiastical patina of authority bestowed on those who dealt in esoteric mysteries.
Yes.
Another way of saying, you know, people sort of envious of detectives.
Yes. You have an aura around you because you are dealing in these matters which other people don't wholly understand and, in fact, haven't access to.
Well, P.D. James, that also reminds us, in the New York Times rave review of your book, they called it a Scrabble lover's joy or something like that because of the way you use those words. Now, you could have just said detectives have an aura. Instead, you said half-ecclesiastical patina of authority. You know, how much do you enjoy using
language? I love using language. I think in English, we both our countries are so lucky because we have the most beautiful, the most versatile, and the richest language in the world to use. And, you know, as a writer, it's a great privilege to use it and to try always to use it better.
Well, which is probably why your policeman is also a poet.
Yes.
An unusual and unexpected detective. This is the 13th in the series. You've sold millions of books. What do you think is the appeal of Adam Dalgliesh?
I think the books appeal to people who do love the mystery. They do want a hero, but they want a hero they can respect, a hero who is a complex and interesting and sensitive human being. I think the attraction, perhaps, of the books as books is the attraction of all mysteries. You know, the story, the puzzle, and the fact that you are going to get a solution, so that in a sense the mystery is a small celebration of order and reason. It presupposes we do indeed live in a rational and comprehensible and a moral universe, even if there seems sometimes to be a great deal of evidence that we don't.
Well, this particular mystery, your newest one, has been compared to Agatha Christie's 10 Little Indians, all the suspects isolated on an island. Was that an homage?
No, not at all. No, in fact, when I decided to set it on an island, I thought, well, I hope people don't just think of Agatha Christie, because it's been a very popular setting, I think, for a number of mystery writers, because, you know, you've got your suspects all there neatly together, cut off from ordinary life, and that's extremely convenient.
Oh, sure.
I didn't want to be compared with Agatha Christie.
Oh, okay, then we're not. We won't, except in the finest of ways. But that is a classic mystery form.
Indeed. Yeah. Indeed it is.
Yeah.
Because you can't allow the stain of suspicion suspicion to spread too far. You've got to have a little group, because you can only deal with about 5 or 6 serious suspects if they're all to be real human beings. You know?
Well, and the victim on this island, poor thing, is Nathan Oliver. He's a writer, not too sympathetic, because he exploits other people in the service of his writing. For example, he gets a reformed alcoholic to fall off the wagon so he can write about it.
Yes.
What are you saying about writers, P.D. James?
Well, Graham Greene said, of course, that writers have a splinter of ice in the heart. And I know what he meant. They stand aside from human experience, from suffering, and observe it and use it. And I think to an extent that has to be true. But, of course, this writer is a particularly disagreeable one. He's used it all his life, ruthlessly.
But what about you, P.D. James? Do you have a splinter of ice in your heart? I can't.
Well,
believe it.
I hope it isn't a very big splinter, actually, Robin, if it's there. But I think there is always in a writer the ability to stand aside from experience and observe it. For example, if I had a friend who was in great distress over something or other and I was trying to comfort her, I would be feeling absolutely, genuinely compassionate and loving and would put my arms around her, and all that would be genuine. Part of my mind would be observing myself doing it, observing how her distress manifested itself, so that perhaps 20 years later I had to describe a scene in which somebody was being comforted, that experience would come back.
Well, you're very honest about that. I think some writers might not confess that.
Well, I think one should be honest, and that seems to me that that can happen.
And we understand you began your writing to support your family.
Well, I didn't really, Robin. It's a very understandable misconception. My husband did come back from the war mentally ill, so I had to earn my living, but it wouldn't have been a realistic way of doing it, frankly. You know, you couldn't possibly rely on it. I went into the National Health Service and got a job, a good, safe, bureaucratic job with a cheque at the end of every month. But the books, they did provide, as it were, the jam on the butter.
By the way, I'm sorry to hear about your husband coming home from the war, as you said, mentally
ill.
Yes. How much did that drive you into writing, or...
I don't think it drove me into writing, because I knew from very early childhood that's what I wanted to be. But it did mean I was rather later beginning than I might otherwise have been, because, you know, I had to do the job and go regularly to the office and visit him when he was in hospital. And it wasn't very easy to start that first book.
Well, P.D. James' new book is called The Lighthouse, Another Adam Dalgliesh Mystery. Can you give us a clue along the way that readers can look for?
The clue to the solution of the mystery.
Yeah, give
this book.
It something that we should...
Oh, let me see. This is very sort of difficult, isn't it? Well, I think we should look to the past as well as the present.
Okay. I want to ask you as well, before we let you go, here in the U.S., we've had this incredibly popular trend of CSI, crime scene investigation television programs.
Yes.
Where the latest in technology and computers, and they come in and, you know. Yeah. How do you feel about the new treatment of crime? Do you try to work that into your books, or do you stay with the old-fashioned gumshoe, thinking it through cerebrally?
Well, Robin, you have to. You just have to bring it in. If you're trying to write a realistic one, I mean, we all know about DNA and what the extraordinary effect of DNA has, you know, on criminal investigation. But what I think is important, and I'm sure it is important in real life, is not to forget the old skills of, you know, door-to-door, knocking, talking to people. I mean, it does amaze me how often with horrific crimes, when somebody is at last arrested, it's somebody the police have had on their books or have seen before, you know, and actually interviewed. So I think you need both the technology and the old-fashioned detection skills, which are rooted, really, in an understanding of human beings and how they act.
That's author and Baroness P.D. James. Her 13th book in the Adam Dalgliesh mystery series, The Lighthouse, comes out in paperback this month. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Deborah Beck.